May I just add my remarks to the commercial here? To have you, if you are not already members of the Institute, we're glad to have you join. It's we don't discriminate a bit. We'd be glad to have anybody join. It's my great pleasure and honor tonight to introduce as our guest speaker the Honorable Mr. Justice Morrow from the Court of Appeal of Alberta, and formerly the judge of the High Court judge for the Northwest Territories. Mr. Justice Morrow is born in Alberta and grew up in that province. Admitted to bar in 1940, and has been a judge of the Territorial Court of the Northwest Territories from 1966 until last year, when he was appointed to the Court of Appeal in Alberta. I think perhaps some training for his rugged life on circuit duties in the Northwest Territories may be found in the fact that he spent some years during the war in command of a minesweeper in the northern Atlantic, and on D-Day. The minesweepers, you know, are those little boats that go in and sweep out the mines to let the bigger boats go in. Nobody ever explained to me what happens to the little boats, but if you survive, I think you're well trained for what Judge Morrow experienced later on. While he was still practicing law in Alberta, he was also busily engaged in sitting on commissions. He twice sat on commissions inquiring into Edmonton civic affairs. Edmonton must have quite a gay civic life. And also into Calgary. Mr. Justice Morrow is going to speak to us tonight on an approach to legal problems in the North. I'm advised that he wasn't always in agreement with the people in Ottawa about how the law in the North was to be administered. In fact, some of the people in Alberta said he was making the law, and some of the people in Ottawa said he was making the law himself, which he disagrees with entirely. However, I'll leave it to Mr. Justice Morrow to explain.
I'm supposed to put this thing on, am I? Thank you very much, Mr. Justice Rattan. Can you hear me up there? Talking about preparation for the North, unlike some of the other naval officers that I knew in the Canadian Navy, I never got to Bermuda or any of those exotic places. Not even Vancouver. I was always working out of Newfoundland and those places. But that was preparing me for the same kind of weather in the Arctic. I suppose every province in Canada, except Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and Prince Edward Island, have a northern region that has somewhat similar problems to the Northwest Territory. And of course I include there the Yukon. But the territories of which I am to speak tonight, and where I spent the last 10 years, and prior to that, used to go up as a defense lawyer for 6 years before that, is rather unique in that it is probably the least developed of the areas. I have to assume that you don't know much about the geography, but I won't go into too much detail on it. It constitutes one-third of Canada's area. It goes all the way from the North Pole to the islands at the bottom of James Bay, to the boundaries, the northern boundaries of the western provinces, and it goes from Greenland across to the Yukon. So it is a big area, but it has a small population, about 40,000 people. Approximately one-third of those people are Eskimo, or Inuit, as they choose to call themselves. One-third Indian, or Dene. And one-third whites are mixed. In that area, we have almost every conceivable type of geography that you find if you went from Vancouver to Halifax. You have mountains, you have plains regions, you have barren grounds, you have Precambrian shield conditions, and then of course you've got a few conditions that are unique to the north. And superimposed on that, you have cold, a longer winter, a shorter summer, and 24 hours of sunlight in the middle of summer and 24 hours of darkness in the middle of winter. All of those things have a tremendous impact on people and the way of life in the area, and undoubtedly has an effect to the extent that it must create problems and does create problems for the legal system. It is also, because of its location and the type of contour and geography, has developed a fragile environment and yet a tough environment. It's a contradiction. A very large portion of it is covered with water when it's not covered with snow and ice. And it's always covered with mosquitoes in the summer. My oldest son made a trip through the north with me, and I'm going to read a little paragraph that he wrote about it. This is the way it hit him, and I'm sure this, and I think this is a good description of the north. The north to me is a land of great contrast, but I miss nature as a friend. Here, he means in the north, nature is mostly the enemy, constantly humbling man by its harshness and rigidity. It is a land of both promise and of hope, perhaps the last frontier of modern man on this continent. It is awesome, and I fear it rather than accept it for what it is. Ours to have and to hold till death do us part. Now that's the impact it made on him. And it's not a bad description. It is just harsh enough that it is difficult to completely relax. In fact, those who do relax may suffer. The people, except those who have been attracted by mining development and that type of thing, are generally located along the Mackenzie River or along the Arctic coast or along the west coast of Hudson's Bay, located in little inlets and bays where there is shelter from the climate and where there is a supply, a more readily available supply of food. Up until shortly after the war, last war, these people were in relative security and balance with their environment. They had adjusted to their local conditions. They didn't have a very lush life, but they were getting by, and culturally they had their own way of life. But following the war, the entry of dew line sites by the Americans and other developments that have come in recent years, a disturbance, we have disturbed them, shall we say, from the south. This is coming at a very rapid rate these days, and it has resulted in problems which of course inevitably reflect themselves in the courts. and in the court system. In other words, this sudden acceleration in exploration, seeking of mineral development, the government has come in as a result of the development in order to protect the development or to protect the people from the development. We don't know which. But anyway, that has put strains on the whole way of life. And it is no accident that in 1955, for the first time, a complete legal system was established in the territories. Prior to that, it had been done from the south with the use of magistrates and justices of the peace. But in 1955, for the first time, a full system was set up, which included a territorial judge who had the powers of both district court and Supreme Court, and the first judge was the late Justice Sissons. I'm sure you've all heard of him. There was a police magistrate who subsequently has been called and described as a magistrate, and today there are two. And then there was a system of local lay justices of the peace set up in each community. Recently, the territorial court was changed to Supreme Court, just as the magistrate's name was changed. And recently, the local government took over the administration of justice, except for the very important function of exercising the discretion of the Attorney General. That remains federal. Now, practically from the start, Justice Sissons came to recognize that there was only one way he could service the North, and that was by introducing a truly circuit court system. The first serious case that he had was what he called the Keokuk case. It was an Eskimo charged with murder from up in the Coronation Gulf area. He was brought down to Yellowknife for his trial, along with all the Eskimo witnesses and police witnesses. And perhaps, if I may, I'll read the judge's remarks in respect to that case, because it typifies what he found and what he thought was wrong about the previous system of bringing them into the white man's community to try. For decades, Eskimos charged with serious offenses were tried in Edmonton, Calgary, Winnipeg, Ottawa, or some other outside point convenient for the authorities before judges and juries who, no matter how well-intentioned, could not know the North and the situation. This would be the last trial in which convenience would be a factor in determining the location. From then on, justice would be taken to every man's door, and he would be tried by a jury of his peers. And in the case of an Eskimo like Keokuk, a jury of his peers would have to include Eskimos. The Yellowknife jurors were six white men. They were good men, honest and fair, but they could not form a jury of peers for an Eskimo. I was also concerned about the witnesses, an interesting crew of Eskimos and their wives. They too were out of their environment. Like Keokuk, they had been called 600 miles for the convenience of the white authorities. Now that was what started the circuit system, which was carried, followed by him, followed by myself, and I'm certain that Justice Tallis, who succeeded me about 3 months ago, will continue the same. And I should say in passing that the magistrate's court follows the same system, a circuit system traveling throughout the territory. The first one was the late Magistrate Finney. Then there was former Chief Magistrate Peter Parker, who is now a provincial judge in Toronto, and Magistrate Mark DeWert, QC, who is now with the Department of Justice here in Vancouver, and I noticed his wife is here tonight. These were all dedicated men who put up with the same hardships and did the same type of work as the territorial court within their own sphere of jurisdiction. Now, one of the problems that you have in administering justice in the North is that the development that I describe as having accelerated in recent years is not hitting the territory with the same intensity in all areas. That is, you could find, if you were to see Yellowknife today, a city that grew in the 10 years that I lived there from 3,700 people to approximately 9,000. It's now a capital. It now has expansive hotels of a type. It has all of the amenities, you might say, that you find in Vancouver. It even has fog a few times. But it is a completely sophisticated community today. And yet, within 500 miles, you can still find communities that are relatively untouched by what we might call a southern way of life. So that it is very difficult to take a law that was passed in Ottawa or in Yellowknife even and attempt to apply it uniformly throughout one-third of Canada's land area. This April, I took the Honorable Ron Basford, Attorney General, on what was my last long circuit through the Arctic, and I retraced almost to every community a circuit that I made in 1960 with the late Justice Sissons. At that time, I was a volunteer defense lawyer. And I can assure you that the changes in that period of time were unbelievable. That is how rapid things are taking place in the North. Now, how do we organize a circuit court? The logistics are quite something if you're going to take a long trip. There's nothing to go across to Hay River or Fort Smith across Great Slave Lake. You just fly there and take your court party with you, and you have a court room. We don't have court houses in the North. We had one, the old liquor store at Hay River, but someone that didn't like the court blew it up. So we beat the Irish on that one. A minimum court party on circuit will be the judge or the magistrate, a clerk of the court, a court reporter, a crown attorney, and a defense lawyer, and of course the pilot or pilots. Sometimes, if we're going on a long trip and we have a serious case, we may be taking police witnesses, medical witnesses, and so on. Sometimes we even have the accused on board, and sometimes we bring the accused back as a prisoner. So that we are quite a composite group. In fact, 2 years ago, I had two cases involving the same Eskimo, charged with rape in both cases. Because of the small community, Spence Bay, that he'd come from, we had to have the trial somewhere else in order to get him a neutral jury. It's a real problem to pick a jury, particularly if you try to have Eskimos on the jury, because the limiting factor is that they must speak the English language. And it's getting better now, but a few years ago it was quite difficult. But we're now getting a generation or several generations of people who have gone through the schools, so we are able now to provide more English-speaking juries. But in order to give him a fair trial, this is the logistical problem I had. We couldn't try him at Spence Bay. Now, we're not talking about going across to New Westminster. We're talking about going across 500 or 600 miles or 300 or 400 miles of barren ground to another community. So the first trial was set for Monday afternoon at Cambridge Bay. So we landed in at Cambridge Bay and with the court party. Immediately while we're choosing the jury, we sent the plane off to Spence Bay to pick up all the witnesses. We brought the witnesses for the two cases. As soon as we finished the first trial at Cambridge Bay, we then had to take the accused, and by now a guard, the complainant for the next case, the witnesses for the next case, and the full court party across the Arctic to Inuvik, because it wouldn't be fair to have a second case involving the same accused in Cambridge Bay. So all in all, we went about 2,000 miles to give that man a fair set of trials. You might be interested to know that on the first case at Cambridge Bay, and we have six-man juries or six-woman juries or six-person juries, depending how you look at it, in the north. At Cambridge Bay, the Crown Attorney used his stand-asides to the extent that he got all an all-female jury. Five Eskimo women and one white woman, or non-Eskimo, I suppose I should say. And as I forecast, they let them off. The defense attorney was quite excited when it started, but after it was over, he felt better. They did convict him of common assault. And then as we flew across the Arctic, along the Arctic coast, the defense lawyer had a divorce involving an Eskimo who was working at a dew line site at Cape Parry along the Arctic coast. So we wired ahead and had him sitting in a truck on the ramp. It was about 40 below zero. We landed, opened the door, turned the propellers off. We had our gowns on, and we gave him his divorce in the cold in the plane, closed the door, and off we went. We got to Inuvik, and the same thing happened there, although we had a mixed jury. He got off again with assault. So then, we're at Inuvik. So we had to go down to Yellowknife, took the accused down under custody, under guard, to the Yellowknife Correctional Institute. Then all of the witnesses on the second case had to be sent back up to Spence Bay. So the logistics are quite something, and yet you do it as it every day, you might say. Sometimes when you line up a long circuit, you take food with you. You make sandwiches as you fly along in the air from settlement to settlement. Otherwise, a lot of these communities haven't got restaurants or cafes or hotels, and you try to avoid spending the night in the small communities because it upsets them. So it's a sort of hit and run type of thing. Sometimes you have to spend a long time in the air getting from one little place to the next. I mentioned that today we have more English-speaking natives. We have several generations now so that we can get them on juries. I've been much more fortunate, I was much more fortunate than Judge Sissons. I had three all-native juries in my time. The first one was at a little Indian community called Snowdrift on Great Slave Lake. In that little community, after we took off the names of the relatives of the accused and the names of the relatives of the complainant, again a rape case, we only had 22 adults left in the community that could speak English. But the lawyers cooperated, and we were able to pick six, and they all ended up as Indians, and they brought in a verdict of not guilty. So we had our first all-Indian jury. At Rankin Inlet, we had our first all-Eskimo jury. And at Aklavik, we had a mixed Eskimo-Indian jury, and all on rape cases, and in all of them, no conviction. Now, some pure legal people might be excited about that. I never got excited about the jury verdicts because they have to live in the community. They know the people. They applied, particularly where you had a native jury, and almost invariably you had one or two on the jury. They applied their own approach to the problem. They applied their own cultural approach, and as far as I'm concerned, if that was the verdict they brought in, fine. I apologize for using the word I so much, but it's hard not to when you've been the only judge for 10 years. But covering the 6 years before that I used to travel with Justice Sissons, and then the 10 that I was a judge, I felt that I had been connected with almost every jury trial since the court was set up. And on the few cases that I hadn't, I spoke to Judge Sissons while he was alive and got his opinion. And I researched every case that had a jury. And it was his opinion and mine that not once did a jury convict when the judge would not have. There were several times when a jury acquitted when the judge would have convicted, but not once was there a conviction when the judge would have let him off. So as far as I'm concerned, I think the record's very clear, they're doing the job. Now I might say that since the intrusion of television into some of the communities, the verdicts are taking longer and we're getting more questions. Obviously, Perry Mason is making his intrusion. But before we had television in the Arctic communities, we could count on a verdict within 45 minutes, as a rule. But not now. And some of the questions are so obviously oriented from a television program, it's unbelievable. In fact, at Copper Mine this spring, there was a case involving an Eskimo who forged a check, which is an unusual offense for those communities. And the police asked him, how come? Well, he said he'd seen it on police story. In arranging circuits, if you're going into the high Arctic, you also have to be careful to go by climate. The judges up there don't operate the same as that down here, holidays in the summer and so on. There you have to go by climate. Well, that means that for the high Arctic, the best time of the year is in April, when you have long sunny days, because the sun comes back very rapidly in the Arctic, but it's still frozen solid, so you have good landing strips on the snow with the skis, and you can travel a long time because there's no darkness, so you can wear the lawyers out if you have to. Similarly, not so much now, but in the first few years, when you had to use float planes to get around in the summer because there were no strips, landing strips, the middle of August was the only time, because that's the only time where you could go from one end of the Northwest Territories to the other and find open water. I found out the hard way when the first year I went on circuit as a judge. I went on a circuit away up past Copper Mine to Politook. Copper Mine was fine. And then to my consternation, when I got over Politook, it was frozen solid. So I had to abort my circuit and come south because of the changing climate and the severity of the weather. To give you an example of the accommodation, You may be sleeping in a nice hotel, Frobisher Bay, Inuvik, Hay River, or you may be sleeping on the floor in a school. You may be sleeping, as I did once, with your head under the sink in a Hudson Bay warehouse. You don't know where you're going to sleep. But if you organize it and you have luck with the weather, you try to hit a place that has proper accommodation. Sometimes you work it so you end up at a dew line site, and then you sleep on the dew line site, which is like a military encampment. And of course, if you can, you try to hit a dew line site because usually you get better food there than most places. On the last circuit that I mentioned a moment ago with Bassford, to give you an idea of one day's travel, we held court at a place called Pangnirtung on Baffin Island early in the morning. We took off from the ice, from the strip, refueled at Frobisher Bay, and picked up an accused that had been over there. Went over to Lake Harbor on the bottom end of Baffin Island and held court, landing on the sea ice. Took off from there and landed at Cape Dorset, further to the west, but still at the bottom end of Baffin Island, and held some cases there. During all this time, the only thing we had to eat was some sandwiches we made from our own bread and cheese and bologna on the plane. By now it's dark. We had to get the police to put flares out to mark the strip, because the community couldn't absorb our large party. And it was not a lighted strip, so we put flares along and took off with the flares. We got into Hall Beach, which is up by the Boothia Peninsula, a dew line site, and they gave us a steak dinner, warmed over about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. Now that's the kind of thing you have to do. Now you don't do it all the time, but generally you push until you get back, and then you relax at Yellowknife for a day or two. I was dubbed the wagon. The tourney was, his function, the court reporter, and so on. And I explained that the sheriff, his function, and they couldn't, I found out afterwards that they thought I was a bit of a liar, because they had seen American movies. And our sheriff wore a parka and a fur mukluks and a fur hat, and any sheriff they'd ever seen had pearl-handled pistols and Stetson. A star. So I bought him a star after that trip. It's surprising how well we keep our schedule, too. On one occasion, we went to Coral Harbor, and the practice is you write ahead. You alert the crown attorney, alerts the police, and they alert the local police. And so they expect you on or about the 15th of August. Then I write a letter about a month ahead saying I expect to be there at the 15th of August. And then a week before I leave, I write another letter hoping it'll get there. Well, on this occasion, I was taking custom adoptions. It wasn't a criminal circuit, it was a custom adoption circuit. And I'd arranged with the local welfare person, an Eskimo, to have everything ready. Well, sure enough, we got there on the 15th of August, and he wasn't there. So they pointed him out. He was out hunting whales out in the bay. So I watched, and eventually he came in, and when he came in, I asked him, I said, I thought you were going to be ready for me. Well, he said, you said you'd be here on the 15th of August. Well, I said, it is the 15th of August. He couldn't believe me. Time means nothing. And maybe there's a moral to that. One of the big problems is language, even now. Language is a problem, particularly in the more primitive communities in the West Arctic, in the areas where there's they've had a longer contact with the white people. Generally, most of them speak English. But when you get the higher and the further to the east you go, the more difficulty you have. And for instance, there is no word for guilty. There's no word for manslaughter. A lot of these words. So you have to be very cautious about guilty pleas. You have to be very cautious about allowing in confessions, because you don't know whether the police had proper interpretation. I mean, I'm not accusing the police of impropriety, but it's just in the doing their job, they may not have had a proper interpreter, and as a result, the man may have been misled. In some of these small communities, they hold the police in awe and perhaps feel they have to be agreeable and say what he wants them to say. So the court has to be much more cautious in those areas. To overcome this difficulty on language, one of the great things in the jury trial is having Eskimos or Indians on the jury. And twice at Frobisher Bay, I had members of the jury, Eskimo members of the jury, interrupt. Now, my practice is to have the one interpreter for the court and one interpreter for the defense. And I give them a little lecture, each is to check the other. Well, both of these jury trials, the Eskimo in the community, in the jury, interrupted and said, he's not interpreting correctly. And on one or two occasions, I've had people in the audience interject. Now, that may be a little unusual down here, but I always welcome it, and I know Judge Sissons did, because you feel you're getting at the facts, which is what you're there for. And on one occasion, it was bad enough that I had to try a new interpreter and fire the other one. Now, recently, the territorial government have organized an official interpreters corps. They get special training. As yet, they're all natives. They're either Indians or Eskimos. If it's an Indian from, say, Fort McPherson, then he'll probably be sent back to Fort McPherson to be available as an interpreter. If he's an Eskimo from the high Arctic, he'll be sent back to Resolute Bay or kept somewhere up in that area. And then we will pick him up and take him with us in that area. That has been a great improvement. But of course, there aren't enough yet. To give you some idea of language problems, I was doing adoptions at Coppermine one time, and I asked one of the Eskimos what his occupation was, and he said, I'm an alcoholic. Now, I'm sure it was an interpretation problem. Then later on the same sittings, the same Eskimo gave away two of his children, one after another. When we got to the second one, I said, now wait a minute, how come you're giving all these children away? He says, I'm loaded. So even there, they all enjoy a good joke, too. They have a great sense of humor up there. The Dry Bones case, which became the Bill of Rights case, had been before a local justice of the peace. And because of language problems, I opened up a plea of guilty in that case and recorded it as not guilty. And then he went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada to make some kind of fame, I suppose. Similarly, in the Tutelik case, which is the sovereignty case, again, there was a guilty plea and I opened it up. We do that quite often when it comes as a de novo appeal to the judge. Of course, one of the biggest problems in the North is alcohol. Maybe that fellow that said he was an alcoholic was right. I doubt if you would need a judge if you didn't have alcohol. The liquor, combined with a general feeling of frustration, contributes more than any other single thing, in my opinion, to the breakdown that we're experiencing in the North. We almost, in some areas, have an almost total destruction of a way of life. And this adjustment reflects in the statistics in the court. Now, today, some of the younger people, the Native people, are, to their credit, addressing themselves to this problem. Their presence, some of them are becoming quite vociferous in attempting to help their people and take a greater part in life and government. The majority of the members of the present Territorial Council at Yellowknife or in the Northwest Territories right now is composed of Native people. I don't know how much press you get on the Berger Commission over the last year down here in Vancouver, but certainly the Native leaders and the Native people were quite noticeably coming forward and saying what they thought and getting it off their chest. These people have come a long way, but there is still a suspicion in some minds that not all of them have come all the way into our way of life. In fact, they don't want to. But we must be very patient in how we treat them and how we apply the law. My observation after 16 years in the North, either as a lawyer or as a judge, is that most of these people that have come before me have not been criminals, but victims of social maladjustment. I think the court, whoever that court is, whether it's magistrate or judge, has to pay attention to that, has to understand this problem, and apply the law less rigorously and less strictly. Give you an idea of what happens. A couple of years ago, we had a murder case involving an Eskimo. We held the trial at Tuktoyaktuk, but the actual offense took place at a dew line site called Anderson Point, or near Anderson Point, way up on the edge of the coast. This Eskimo had been out for about 2 weeks with his dog team in the cold, trapping, and as he came by the dew line site, he knew there was one family of Eskimos. The dew line personnel are white people, but there was one Eskimo community that was helping the dew line work there. He came in, fed his dogs, had a nice meal, then they started to have a social hour. The man of the house had to go to work on the dew line site. He told him there was a white man on the dew line site that was very interested in dog teams and Eskimos. So he sent him back down to the house. This fellow brought his bottle of rum with him. They had a few social drinks. They were arranging to go out the next day and have a dog team ride. Everyone's, the old phrase of my day was copacetic. I don't know what they use now. All of a sudden, the Eskimo got up, without a word, walked outside, grabbed his rifle, came in and shot the white man. Now, when he was sent out for examination, they discovered he was suffering from latent epilepsy. He didn't know he had that condition. And it was only when he had this excessive amount of alcohol that he went the way he did. The interesting thing about that trial was that he would never admit or accept the fact that he could have done the offense. His lawyer wanted him to plead guilty to manslaughter, but he wouldn't plead guilty to manslaughter because he didn't believe he had done it. At the end of the trial, when the jury, five Eskimos and one white, brought in a verdict of manslaughter, he asked if he could speak to the court. And having heard all of the evidence, he then got up and he said, "Now I know what happened. I am sorry." Now that's the type of thing you still run into. You run into, in the odd place, an undercurrent of witchcraft and shamanism yet. In fact, in 1965, some of you may remember, there's a lot of publicity on the Shuyuk case, where a woman, an Eskimo, was killed, was executed by the community, really, through the agency of her son and the Eskimo boy that I defended, because she went crazy and was threatening all of them with a spell. And they felt they had to save their community. That was the last extreme case of that time. But just to give you an idea, to get back to liquor for a moment, in 1966, in one community in the north, almost the entire adult Indian population passed through the Justice of the Peace Court in 1 year. Almost the entire population. In 1974, as a result of the highway construction that was underway, the Mackenzie Highway in the Fort Simpson area, and the increased contact with outside whites, that is, truck drivers and so on, who come up for the period and then go out again and have no stake in the community, Magistrate Parker had to fly over in 1 week alone, and he in one sitting had 45 juvenile cases, all involving young Indian boys and girls and alcohol, which gives you some idea of what may come if there's a continual and an increased development as a result of the pipeline and so on. The court finds itself in the front line here. And while it may be the instrument of the law, it is also the buffer. It has to be. For many years ahead, in my opinion anyway, the court must be careful to show a sympathetic approach in applying the law, particularly the criminal law. Now, I think my time's running out. I could mention other cases. There have been cases involving adoptions, the validity of Eskimo marriages, custom marriages, and so on. Cases involving the game laws, treaty rights, the Indians. The natives have lost the cases involving the game, but so far the court has been able to protect their culture in respect to adoptions and in respect to marriage. One of the most unusual cases in respect to native adoption is one that came before me about a year ago, where a white woman married an Indian, a treaty Indian. And she wanted to adopt a child but not through the adoption ordinance, but by native custom. At the time she had married, not only had she gone through the normal Orthodox marriage ceremony, but she also went through the traditional Indian ceremony of marriage. She became a card-carrying treaty Indian under the Indian Act, and she took the position that she was entitled to be considered as an Indian for the purposes of a custom adoption. And I agreed with her. So that is about the limit to which their cultures and customs have been accepted to date in the law in our area. It's interesting, perhaps, to know that when the Alaska Land Claims Settlement took place, they sent over for all of these judgments from our court, from the territorial court, because we had already pioneered this adoption business and marriage business, and now they had to go through it all and process it in order to find out who got the money. I don't know what happened, but I assume they copied our cases over there. I never heard the result. When it comes to bail, we always used to joke in the Northwest Territories that we were ahead of the government on its bail reform legislation. It was automatic bail in the Northwest Territories unless the person was psychotic. We never worried about him running away, because where would he go? In order to run the territory, you had to allow them to apply by telegraph, by long-distance phone, by telex, whatever the communication is, and you'd grant bail accordingly. In fact, no matter where the court was, you were always hearing applications by long-distance phone for injunctions, certiorari's. Twice I granted habeas corpus over the long-distance phone, because it wasn't practical to hold it up until you went 700 or 800 miles. To help improve their knowledge, at the invitation of the Minister of Justice some years ago, I prepared a little handbook called Justice in the North. It's been translated into Eskimo syllabics and into the Eskimo language and into English. And for the Indians who don't appear to have, those that don't appear to have a written language, they put that on the local radio station. So that an attempt is being made, and there are other attempts being made, to give them instruction in their rights. In the North, they now have full legal aid systems. They're now developing lay advisors, court workers in the different areas to help, and the judge and the magistrates and the lawyers try to instruct them and help them out. And before I close, I should mention that one of the most important phrases in the law that both Judge Sissons and I relied on was the Northwest Territories Act, which is the Constitution up there. That statute provides that the law of England, as of July 15, 1870, shall apply, except where changed by Canadian or territorial statute. And this is the phrase that we relied on, insofar as they are applicable to the territories. Now that was a pretty elastic phrase. A judge is required to apply the law, that is the substantive law, but I like to think that in the territories, because of the peculiar conditions, you have to be very flexible on procedural law. And to much like Nelson at Trafalgar, you have to close your eyes to the irregularities in procedure. And perhaps I can read out a phrase that I put in a judgment involving an Indian once, where obviously, matter of fact, Mrs. DeWert will enjoy hearing this because it was her husband that argued the point successfully in front of me. There's no question about it, an appeal had been filed by an Indian. He was in the jail. The warden wrote out the notice of appeal for him because the person was illiterate. It was sent in, but it was not served properly. Now, under the provisions of the criminal code as it then was, that was an invalid appeal. When it came in front of me and the Crown Attorney attempted to knock it out, I ruled the other way, and in summing up, this is what I said. To me, procedural rules, such as we are dealing with here, are to assist the court in holding orderly trials, what should never become the instrument of a denial of justice. It will have to be a higher court than mine that will have the unpleasant duty to interpret the law in a manner which will deny justice to our native people if, of course, my judgment is appealed higher. Now, in preparing that judgment, I went through the records from 1955 up to the date of that case, and I found that if you had applied the law strictly, 40% of the successful appeals heard by the late Justice Sissons and myself to that date would have been disallowed. So I refused to follow it, and I was lucky, because shortly after that, the new Prime Minister Trudeau, who was still Minister of Justice, visited Yellowknife. And the press asked him about the case at a press conference, and he not only instructed no appeal, but when he got back, he amended the provision. So today, a letter is sufficient. Now, the last thing, and then I'll quit. One of the most flexible things you have to do, in my opinion, in the North as yet, is be flexible in sentencing. I don't think you can apply the normal sentencing to the extent you might do here. Both Judge Sissons and I, and the magistrates, are inclined to resort more to suspended sentences and probation. This was particularly the case up until about 2 years ago, because it was absolutely cruel to send a primitive Eskimo or Indian to a place like Prince Albert. It was destructive. Some of them committed suicide. If they survived, they would come back to their unsophisticated community as professionals. For instance, in one community, a man who had a native who had been sent to the penitentiary, within 4 days of his return, they had the first forgery and first safe cracking in the community. The police knew exactly who it was because only one had ever been to the professional school of forgery and safe breaking. So that, however, recently the government got the message and they now have declared the Correctional Institute at Yellowknife to be a penitentiary. So that unless there is some exceptional reason, the native people are not being sent out of the territory. Now that's a big step forward because it is destructive to send them out. And utterly cruel to take a person from the north end of Baffin Island who's been a nomad and been out in the country all his life, a hunter, used to certain types of food, can't speak English, and put him down in a southern institution where no one knows who he is or how to talk to him or what he likes, and no relatives can visit. If the reverse was to take place, I'm sure you'd soon have a rebellion if you sent someone from Vancouver to an institution at Resolute Bay. I'll just close by reading from a talk I gave a year ago, which I think the expression then, I think, is still valid. Looking to the future, as the energy crisis heats up, with the promised increase in exploration for all sorts of mineral resources in Canada's last frontier, with pipeline plans and pipeline hearings, there are bound to be further problems coming before our criminal justice system. It will take the combined effort of and a full understanding by all Canadians of our northern native problems. The social maladjustment, the effort to retain some of the old culture, the almost instinctive and obsessive struggle and fight that is emerging, as witness the court case presently before the appeal court. So that's the Caveat case. It's now in the Supreme Court of Canada. If we are to avoid our court system becoming synonymous with oppression, our native people of the North, well funded by many grants, are now girding for battle in the courts, in appearances before the Berger Commission, and in the political arena. It is very important that we not only understand this new aspiration, but that we also respect it. They have, as yet, chosen the legal route, the constitutional route. It is for all Canadians to ensure that they are met halfway, that they are treated decently and as equal citizens, if a different and more sinister militancy is to be avoided. I see no reason to change what I said a year ago. I thank you. I understand that I'm to answer questions if I can. Or did you want to say?
No, I was really going to say that we don't want to let this man off with just a speech like this. And he's quite willing to answer some questions, so please fire away.
Yes?
So much of your work was a result of alcohol, or
yes.
Any answers to what to do about the problem of alcohol?
I think they have to solve it themselves. I notice in one of the current newspapers from Inuvik where some of the communities are going what we call local option. They're having their own vote and they're trying to keep alcohol out. Now that to some extent will help. But I must say I'm very pessimistic on that, because 6 years ago I made a trip to Greenland. And if anyone can protect a community from alcohol, you would think Greenland, because it's surrounded by either ice or water. I was back there a year ago, and they are worse than we are. And they control their own affairs on that. They wanted alcohol. So I don't know. I'm afraid I'm somewhat pessimistic. Yes? Yes. Well, alcohol, I suppose an alcoholic, I'm not an expert on the alcoholic part, but I like a drink myself, but I do think that one's inhibitions are lost with the increased consumption of alcohol. I think that's fairly elementary. Well, now, if you take a person who has not had, what do you want to call it, 1900 years of civilization pounded into him, or what we call civilization pounded into him, and I'm merely expressing what the psychiatrists have said in cases before me, his inhibitions are not as deep. That is, inhibitions as in our culture. Now, he has inhibitions of his own in his culture, but they're different. and they don't always meet in the courtroom. So that if a hunter has been drunk, he's more apt, and he has, during, say, his lifetime or the last few years, felt frustrated by the way the white man's intrusion into his community, the disappearance of game, the disturbance of his area, the fact that the young girls are carrying on with the white boys, and so on. This is all part of the frustration. Well, then when he gets drunk and the inhibitions removed, he's going to become antagonistic. He may grab a gun or a club or use his fist, more likely to than someone else. That's really, I think, oversimplifying.
So then you're saying that alcohol is a symptom of maladjustment?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes? Yes, well, no, I'm not an expert, but my, what's that? The question is, could I explain why the juries on rape cases in those areas seem to result in acquittals? I don't think, and I have to say it must have something to do with their own culture. And I won't go any further than that because I'm certainly not an expert on it. But I'm speaking from my own personal observation in the courtroom, both as a defense lawyer for 6 years and then 10 years as a judge. Almost invariably, if it's just what we would call a rape with no serious beating up or assault, you do not get a conviction. It is the brutality of the attack that brings the conviction. And now it may be they don't understand the word rape, although we try to explain it to the jury, but to them it's the assault, the brutality of the attack on the woman. Now whether that's because in their way of life the woman is supposed to submit, and there's nothing to that act, it's the brutality. So if you have a brutal attack, you will almost invariably get a conviction, not of rape, unless it's very brutal, but you will get a conviction of assault causing bodily harm or common assault. That's what I meant. Yes? No, I don't think, I don't want to get into that, because we had 6 women on a jury and they did the same thing. All right. Maybe they got the right idea. Yes?
I may have got the story wrong, but the impression I got from what you were saying was that the local inhabitants didn't seem to like me very much. When I was up the Arctic, they longed for me to stay there, but when you go to a settlement, you're very pleased to get out as fast as possible.
Can I interrupt you before you go too far? I wasn't saying, maybe they don't like me, I don't know about that, but whether they did or didn't, we felt we were imposing. Because they didn't have facilities to look after us, and we embarrassed them.
Well, yeah. Again, I feel that maybe you're sort of missing the point of things. You see the embarrassment, they haven't got facilities, and therefore you get out fast, and therefore maybe you miss the point. I'm a New Zealander by birth, and the Maoris have a practice there, at least they used to have a practice in the old days, that if a visitor came to their community, they stayed just as long as they wished. They would never turn you away. And you feel now...
I don't think we're quite the normal visitor. I've been in the communities and they put on dances and so on. I'm not talking about that kind of hospitality. I'm talking about bringing a party of 10 or 15 people into a very small community that has no hotels and no restaurant and no coffee shop or anything. And it would be ridiculous for us to impose ourselves. They would look after us. They would be polite to us. They'd be kind to us. But we ourselves would feel badly about it.
Yes, but again, I'm sorry to press this point.
No, I'm the wrong one to use that on. But go ahead.
Maybe this is what was happening. You were sort of avoiding the issue. If you had faced up to it more and stayed there, you could have got over your sort of shock and the cultural shock.
All right, I'll tell you, I have two answers to that. 16 years ago, when I made a circuit with Justice Sissons, we were in a single-engine otter. We were held up by weather three times, about every third day. We had to live in the communities. We went into Sac Harbor in April. Now get this, in April 1960, and we took in their Christmas mail. They were 4 months late getting their mail. That's how unsophisticated the area was in 1960. I can assure you we were welcome because we brought their mail, long overdue. But by the second day, we were supposed to go on that day, but by the time we were in the second day and they started to unfreeze the caribou steaks that they were saving for special occasions because they were running out of food with this extra crew, and I was under the sink sleeping and someone else was somewhere else. The only one in the party that had a bed was the judge, and that's because the policeman got out of bed. Now, after two or three days, I don't care how polite they are and how hospitable they are, you wear out your welcome. That's all I mean. It's a pride. Then the second thing.
No, please.
Just one last thing on it. The second thing is a much more practical thing. The last few years when I was on circuit, if I was going to do my work, I couldn't afford the time. Let's put it that way. Yes? Now, what do you mean by legal customs? Well, they probably don't look upon them as legal. Their custom of adoption, for example. I enjoy custom adoptions because you got to see the real people on those kind of sittings. There wasn't no adversary system. You were trying to help them out, and they recognized it. And I'll give you some examples. They have a system that you're living in. It's a relic. You heard the remarks that my son wrote in his article. If there's one thing that impresses you in the Arctic, it's survival. Now we're looking at, particularly in the Eskimos, we're looking at people who for thousands of years survived in an area where there are no trees, there is really nothing but hardship. Now, to them, everything was survival. If the first child was not a son, I'm going back to the tradition, if the first child was not a son, they snuck the child out immediately. In fact, in 1960, I defended an Eskimo lady who did exactly that, the last infanticide case by their custom in our history. Now they know they shouldn't, and now mother's allowances make it worthwhile, but in 1960 it wasn't. So she killed her child. Now that's one of the things. The next thing is that you must have a female in every igloo, if you want to put it that way, to chew your mukluks and do the sewing. It's all part of a survival. The man hunts, the woman looks after the children and the home. She's boss in the igloo, the man's boss on the tundra. Now, in order to survive, if someone can't have children, they develop this system of custom adoption. It's straight survival. So if your wife has already produced a son who will be your hunter and a daughter who will look after someone's foot gear, if you want to be vulgar about it, and then you have another child, your wife has another child, and your neighbor across the way does not have a child, immediately that child is spoken for, before it's even born. This all goes on. It's all a relic of survival. They have a much higher sense of survival than we have. They have a system that we're trying to legislate in our welfare statutes. There is in a truly Eskimo or Indian community where there has been no great intrusion of the white man's ways and the breakdown of their culture, there isn't an infant that is abandoned. They're all looked after. They're all cared for. You don't need welfare state for that type of thing. For instance, I can remember one woman, and it really, they're really tearjerkers when you think of it. I asked one Eskimo woman why she was giving her child away. And this was her answer. Because I wanted this child to live. All my others died. You see, they don't have farmers' formula and all this kind of stuff and pediatricians. Apparently all of her children had died at birth. And she wanted one to live. So it was spoken for as soon as she was pregnant. Another woman who apparently had had success with children had spoken for it. And that child went to that woman. Now that's the type of thing you get in adoption. That is what I mean by one of their systems. Now the marriage is the same way. They have their own way of marriage. After all, they were getting married long before we came along with a marriage ordinance. That's about all I can say. I don't think they're aware that they have a legal system. They had a much more, I suppose when one reads about their customs, they had a much more flexible jail system too. They banished them. And I'll tell you something. If you got banished at the north end of Baffin Island in the middle of winter, there wouldn't be any jail riot.
But these custom adoptions and custom marriages are legalized by the court.
We have, both Justice Sissons and I have ruled, and the Court of Appeal of Alberta, which is the Court of Appeal for the Territories, have agreed. So we have established, they won on that. Yes?
Say they don't recognize the boundary between the United States and Canada, and apparently there are some members of the organization in British Columbia. Do you happen to know whether it's an active organization?
Oh, I don't try to keep track of those people, those kind of people, but I'll tell you on the same situation, if you like. When they brought in marriage allowances some years ago for the first time and gave it to the native people in the north, a lot of Eskimos from Alaska moved over to Iqaluit. You see, they're nomads. They don't recognize territorial land. They go where the food is. So the mother's allowance was quite practical. So they located in the Delta. Then when the land claim settlement of Alaska took place a few years ago, they went back and qualified for the land grant. So there's nothing wrong with it. Yes? Well, I got to be careful what I say because I'm now a member. Yes? Oh, I'm sorry. The question was, she wants to know what was the rationale back of my sentencing of the man who was epileptic and was convicted of manslaughter, right? I gave him 4 years. Now, I have to be careful what I say, because I'm now a member of the Court of Appeal of the Northwest Territories as a member of the Court of Appeal of Alberta. If I'd given him any less, it would have appealed and he'd have got more. So I figured that would be about right. Yes?
We appreciate very much what your son wrote, and I'm sure we would all join in
I will, thank you. There's someone behind you asked a question. Yes?
How old is your son?
Oh, he's about 28 now. About 25. Well, do you want to hear the rest of the story?
Yes.
All right. About, I'll come to you in a minute. I'm going to tell her the rest of the story of the man who has epilepsy. He went to Prince Albert. I made a point of visiting the penitentiaries. I went to Prince Albert. I even warned them, the authorities, that I was coming well ahead. I went there. And I was shocked. Not one of the recommendations that I had made as a trial judge, not one of his papers, not one of the psychiatric reports had reached the penitentiary. The man was brought to me. He was absolutely breaking apart. So I started correspondence to get him brought back to the North. And this, he did contribute to bringing the penitentiary to Yellowknife. In the meantime, as a result of his mental condition, he was charged with attempting to kill someone in the cell at Prince Albert. Subsequent to that, and convicted, subsequent to that, he heard that the Eskimo family were up way up on the Arctic coast, that this episode had taken place, and who were his friends had been killed in a fire. Their house burnt down. As a result, he committed suicide. Now that's the story. Yes? Yes, but you've got to remember that the majority of the people in the Northwest Territories are natives. The majority of the natives are poor people, the maladjusted people. A very large number of the white people in the Northwest Territories are civil servants, and they never get into trouble. That question, I did my part by writing a judgment about 40 pages long discussing their rights in what we call a caveat case, which is presently before the Supreme Court of Canada. I don't think I should discuss it because I'm under appeal. But I think my position is quite clear.
What's the feeling do you have,
yes,
amongst the people there now of whether they're secure or sympathetic impressed by the new system of justice that's been imposed upon them? Do you sense that they are accepting and impressed with?
Would you mind repeating that?
He wants to know, I'm oversimplifying the question, what feeling they may have about the system of justice that's being imposed upon them. That's a difficult thing to answer. First of all, it puts me on the hot seat because I, for 10 years certainly, I've been the embodiment of it. So you're asking me to say that I'm not doing my job. However, let's put it this way. If one can get anything from the press in the last while, I think the court has come out, has fared, and by court I mean all levels, fares better than any other branch of government in the North. I think they recognize, and I think the manner in which the high esteem in which they hold Justice Berger on his inquiry, they recognize, I think, that judges stand up for them, unlike certain other people. I think that's the tradition of Justice Sissons. They recognize that he stood up for them. Sure, they may criticize certain things, but basically, I think they accept the fact that that's the one thing they have left. Now, to give you an example, the last time I was at Fort Simpson, I had the unpleasant duty. They had a meeting of their Indian Brotherhood, and they asked the Commissioner of the Northwest Territories to close the bars in Fort Simpson so that their meeting would not be end up in the bars. And he did. He just passed a resolution closing the bars. Well, the liquor outlets got their lawyer, and he brought a certiorari application attacking what the commissioner had done. And I flew the court because it was an emergency and we only had 3 days. I immediately collected all of the lawyers together and we flew over to Fort Simpson and set up court. There was no question about it. The commissioner did not set it aside properly. He could have, but he couldn't in 3 days, if you get the problem. The legislation did not permit him to do what he did. So I had to set it aside. In setting it aside, I said I sympathized with the request of the Indians, but I had a duty to perform. Now, that was not a procedural matter. That was a substantive rule, so I felt I had to apply the law. But as I went out of the courtroom, and this is the only time it happened in my 10 years there, the chief came up and waved his fist, not at me, but in the air, and said, "We're getting tired of doing it your way." Now, that is why I made those remarks at the end of my so-called talk. In other words, if we do not let them win once in a while, in other words, if we do not demonstrate that they get a fair break under our law, some of them will do something. Not more, most of them not, no.
The costs and these long distance things, is there any way of equitably settling those?
Well, the natives are not pay, don't pay them. No, it's absorbed by the government. Yeah. There's a complete, the first complete legal aid system in Canada was the one that the Honorable John Turner brought in the Northwest Territories a few years ago. They have complete legal aid for civil as well as criminal, unlike any other jurisdiction. Divorces, everything. To give you an example, I'll talk about cost. We hear a bit about it in the newspapers these days. Well, there was an Eskimo wanted a divorce at the Belcher Islands. Now, you know the Belcher Islands are down in beginning of James Bay. So I lined up his divorce at the same time as a circuit to Frobisher Bay. And if you had a map, you'd see that I was going about 1,200 miles out of my way. We took off from Yellowknife. We went down by way of Churchill, landed in the Belcher Islands an hour before dark, landed right on the sea ice because there's no airport. And because of darkness and no way of getting off if it once got dark, I had everyone gowned. I always insist on the full regalia so they knew we were different from the government. That's very important. Didn't want to have any mistakes. We turned off the propellers, and of course, the minute the propellers are off, there's no heat on the airplane. The doors open, and I called out, and there was the man who wanted his divorce, and there was a man who could speak the language, so we commandeered him and got him in the plane, and then I said, "This is open court," so all the rest, the plane was full of people in their parkas. And under the Divorce Act, as we now have it, the judge has to make sure that there's no chance of reconciliation. So we asked him whether he was prepared to go ahead and what the chances of reconciliation are. Now, we've come 900 miles. And he said, "Yeah, I think I'd like to talk to my wife again." Now,
His wife was only at Resolute Bay, about 1,000 miles away. So I said, all right, Mr. So-and-so, I'll see you next year. And sure enough, I came back next year and he got his divorce. He had seen her. He had actually seen her. How he did, I don't know. But they get around that country. And so he got his divorce. And if you want to hear the rest of it, just about a month after I came down to Calgary, I got a letter from his lawyer saying that he thought I would enjoy hearing what had happened. He had now gone back and remarried his wife. Now that 20-minute episode that took two occasions, I suppose, cost the government of Canada $5,000 or $6,000. But at least it shows that the government of Canada is giving them equal service to anyone else. Yes?
Is there any reason in your informal lives that they go through the formality of the divorce?
Well, that was one that I was hoping I'd get, but I have never had it yet. Any divorce that I've had with the native people has always been what one would call a Christian marriage. You must remember that the Anglican Church and the Roman Catholic Church is very strong in these areas, and these were marriages that had been properly done.
Don't hear anything of our local plague breaking an entry.
Oh, that's becoming, but that comes with the liquor and with the juvenile. As you get idleness, as you get the increased population with nothing to do, it's the idleness combined with liquor, then you get it. In fact, the first few years to Frobisher Bay was a breaking and entering into the liquor store. And finally, I blasted the liquor store and said they should get a better lock. And that helped there.
Well, I think, ladies and gentlemen, that we could go on for another half hour, I presume, but I think our speaker is entitled to a little rest.
Give you this back.
Thank you. I do want to say, sir, that it's a wonderful excuse you've given, a wonderful explanation why we wear gowns in court. And I shall promptly adopt it from now on. Before I call upon thank you for the speaker, I'm going to put up a commercial here for Dr. Kay Lamb, who will be speaking to us next week. Dr. Kay Lamb had a great deal to do with the Mackenzie King Diaries when he was in Ottawa as archivist, and you all know him as an old friend of the university here, and I recommend that you come back to hear him next week. I'll now call on Dr. Volk to thank our speaker.
I think, Justice Rattan, you should also reintroduce wigs, perhaps, in addition to the robes. We've had such an entertaining talk tonight from a judge, and one always hesitates to express any opinion about things that judges do, and I'm in a difficult position. When it's particularly a difficult position if one is a university administrator and commits a number of crimes that university administrators do. But I hope that if I ever face a judge, it will be one like Judge Murrow and the kind of jury that he has too. We've got a great deal to be thankful for tonight. Judge Murrow has evoked some of our history for us. We had, when we were a frontier, a circuit judge, Matthew Begbie, who I think was a judge rather in the style of the kind of judge that we heard about today. I mean, who could ride overnight on a horse and build a gallows and dispense justice quickly. And with a great deal of humanity, too. One wonders how much our law schools and our judges and our lawyers might not learn from the way justice is dispensed in the North. I think that we do have people who have perhaps the humanity and perhaps even the humor and the flexibility that Judge Murrow has had to display in the North regularly. At least I hope we have the humor in the courts occasionally. But there's some things that I think that we definitely don't have in our courts, and or in our law school students, and in our lawyers, and that one has to have in the North. One of these is certainly stamina, the kind of stamina that that allows a person to travel the way Judge Murrow did, I think is extremely unusual. And perhaps we should try to inculcate that in our students. And the other one, I think, is perhaps even more important, and that's efficiency. I was very impressed with the way cases are handled quickly and in the North. I think on behalf of all of you, we want to thank Judge Murrow tonight, not only for the way he's dispensed justice in the North, but also for speaking so entertainingly and articulately about the justice in the North.
Meeting is now adjourned.